Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. With the death of Fidel Castro and a changing American presidential administration, the future of the latest and most significant thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations since Castro took power is at the tip of the pendulum. It could swing either way. With Fidel Castro gone and brother Raul in his mid-80s, one might think that a more normal relationship with the island country is the more likely future. But my guest today urges caution and believes the system the Castros created won't end with the end of their leadership. Ambassador Dennis Hayes was a lifelong Foreign Service officer who served as the coordinator of Cuban affairs at the State Department in the mid-1990s during the Cuban rafter crisis. He later resigned that post in protest of a Clinton administration policy shift he couldn't support. For that, he received the Christian Herter Award for Intellectual Courage and Creative Dissent in 1996 for his actions as Cuban coordinator. In addition to that post, he served in posts in Jamaica, Burundi, and Guyana, and was director of Mexican affairs during the implementation of NAFTA, and was ambassador to Suriname. Since his retirement, he has served on the Cuban-American National Foundation as a consultant to government and remains a hardliner concerning the U.S. embargo of Cuba. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and I spoke with him while he was here. Ambassador Hayes, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, in the wake of the death of Fidel Castro, how is this likely to change the United States and Cuban relations over the next several years? I mean, what's your thought? There have been a lot of people that you've been involved with that were actually looking forward to this day where Fidel Castro was no longer in Cuba and no longer a part of this very tangled relationship we have. What do you think things are going to look like over the next couple of years with him gone?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, obviously, Fidel was 90 years old, and the revolution was 1959. So, I mean, he's been an important part, obviously, of this relationship. He certainly has been the overwhelming presence inside Cuba itself. The interesting thing to me is like many organizations or dynasties or what have you, is you get a point where there has to be a transition because the founder or what have you will pass along. He, of course, has shifted over with his brother, who has basically run the country for the past 10 years. But his brother is in his mid-80s now. And so all of us, and when I say us, I mean both people on the island and off the island who care about the future of this nation, wonder, you know, how is the Cuban regime going to be able to handle this? I have to tell you, I'm not terribly optimistic because if you've seen what's happened over the past few years, is that the military, which is the most well-organized, disciplined force in Cuba, a lot of the brightest people go into the military, and they also run the economy. Most of the businesses all report back through. There's a group called GAESA, which is run by a general named Rodriguez, who is married to Raul Castro's daughter. So, and if you look at the other side of the equation, in the army and the sort of secret services, if you will, the key figure there is Alejandro Castro. So he has his son on the sort of military and security side, and he's got his son-in-law on the economic side. And the question is, if they just sort of take over and they become the new Fidel and Raul, then not a lot is going to change.
So you really sounds like you expect this to be sort of a nepotistic sort of regime change.
I think that's most likely. I mean, the military now have gotten a taste of, I don't want to say the good life, but a relatively better life than what they had done before. And so you have to say, well, why would they give up this power and influence unless they are required to? I mean, one would hope that they would see that it's in the nation's interest for them to move down a certain path. I don't think that they've come to that realization yet.
Are there any reformers that are still within the government? I mean, when you look at the bench,
yeah.
Is there somebody, this country like the United States could say, this might be the guy we could do business
with? We've been looking for that guy for 50 years, and we haven't found him. Remember, in Cuba, there's the military, there's the party, and there's the government. And, of course, Fidel was the head of all three of these, and so he was able to control everything. You don't advance very far if you deviate from the orthodoxy. Now, the interesting question is there a Gorbachev out there? I mean, somebody who could come up to be into a position of power and then use that authority to help promote a reform, gradual or not so gradual. One quick story I'll tell you on that. I had a professional relationship with a Russian diplomat who actually was the interpreter when Gorbachev went to Havana to tell Fidel that they were going to cut back on the subsidies and the oil for sugar and all this other stuff that was going on. And in making this presentation, Gorbachev told Castro, look, well, it's not all bad news. We have this new stuff. It's called glasnost and perestroika, and you might want to try it. And my colleague said Castro literally jumped up out of his chair and went right into the face and started screaming at him and telling him, you are destroying everything, the blood of the martyrs, and you are throwing it all away. And then you say, well, okay, you know, what happened to Gorbachev after that and what happened to Castro? Well, Castro stayed in power. Gorbachev started doing Pizza Hut commercials for a while. And now who knows where he is?
Well, right now, though, with Fidel Castro's death,
yep.
You're seeing the European Union, which has always had some trade, re-look at their relationship with Cuba with the idea of really opening up those ties. Do you expect that to happen?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I frequently would hear is, well, we're going to miss the boat because Cuba will open up and we'll miss the boat. And another friend of mine from Miami says, you don't understand. We are the boat. The boat gets there when we get there. And geography and history and the links between families, I think that's pretty much the case. But the concern that I have, and you know, I'm a diplomat. I believe in negotiation. I believe in discussions. I believe in step by step. I mean, in all of these things. But it's important that there be will on both sides, that it's not just enough for us to say we want something to happen. There has to be a reciprocal action from the other side. And up until now, that has not been there.
They would certainly welcome, I think at this point, from what I can see, wouldn't they welcome investment?
You know, when you say welcome investment, I mean,
welcoming the money coming in, but they would not want the money going out.
Well, yeah, they would be happy to have the money coming in, but they're setting the terms. As I mentioned, basically the construction, the telecommunications, the tourism, ABA, everything is controlled by the military. So the options that we, the Europeans, the Latins, everybody has is to make a deal with military-run organizations. In my career, I mean, this is 20, 25 years ago now when I first started doing this, our hope had been to bypass the government and to reach directly to Cuban people. Look, Cuban people are wonderful. They're friendly. They're outgoing. They like Americans. And most of them, like us, they just want a better life. You know, they want a better life for themselves. They want their children to have opportunities and chances. And so the great tragedy to me in Cuba is generations now have been prevented from having this, that they're left with a choice of fleeing the country, either getting on a raft or trying to get a visa somehow and going to Costa Rica and then walking across the border in the United States, or staying where they have very limited options before them. And it's unfortunate. I mean, we see this time and time again, just people who are very bright, very educated, and their choices are, I mean, literally, we have cases of brain surgeons who become bellmen. And you know, nothing wrong with being a bellman, but in Cuba, you're financially much better off working for tips from tourists than you are working at a high level of medicine or academia.
You know, you do hear those stories. You also hear stories from a lot of people within the regime that like the regime as it is. They have health care. They have a lot of things, you know, and you do hear those stories as well.
You do. And look, particularly in the early years, there was a lot of resources that were put into health care and education. Again, remember, Cuba was the second or third richest country in Latin America before all this happened. And it was an educated group, and there were more TV sets per capita than in America at that time. The higher wages than Germany or France at that time. So they had a base to start from. And you know, they did some things and some good things in there. And then we can get into the question of Mussolini and, you know, he made the trains run on time. And does that exempt you from other things? The sad thing, though, is, of course, this was all dependent upon having resources from outside, either the Russians or more recently the Venezuelans, who have given them billions of dollars worth of free oil. And the sad reality is there's now a two-tier system for medicine. If you or I wanted to go down to Cuba, we could get first world attention at a much cheaper price. But if you're a Cuban citizen and you only have pesos, not dollars, then we see a lot of this. I mean, literally, there's no sheets on the beds in the hospital. You have to buy aspirin off the black market. I mean these kinds of things. So it's Cuba's got a lot of problems. And from my perspective, a lot of them are self-imposed. But nevertheless, it's hurting people very badly.
Now, you were talking about, you know, how Russia and the Soviet Union was very much subsidizing the regime for many years. That has lessened, but I gather that Putin has yet another overture to the Cubans saying they'll be even less.
well, it's hard to go less than what they had. They are talking about...
But Putin's been saying you need to open up.
He's been telling him you need to stand on your own feet.
Yeah.
And again, Raul and Fidel, they basically were one person. I mean, they complemented each other very well, and they did have their differences. Raul has always been a little more enamored of what we would probably call the China model, where you have a bit more economic activity, but you maintain that hard control on the political side. But he's not yet prepared to go as far as China has. I mean, there's no Deng Xiaoping who's going to say being rich is fabulous or whatever the quote was. It's still this feeling that there has to be equality, and the equality is at a very low level, unless you're one of the top apparatchiks, of course. That's a little different.
Now, the Obama administration has opened up this relationship quite a bit through executive order.
Yep.
You had a lot of big companies exploiting those executive orders to make deal overtures to the Cuban.
Making overtures.
And what I'm reading now is that actually the Cubans drugged their feet on accepting those. Now, with a new Trump administration coming in, there's talk that maybe that will be accelerated. What do you expect to happen on that deal?
Well,
as far as how the embargo continues.
Again, I was one of those when I first started working on Cuba professionally. I was one of these guys who said, well, you know, kumbaya, let's find a way. We'll find a middle ground. You take a step, I take all of that. And what quickly became apparent to me, certainly, was the Cubans were prepared to take anything I gave them, but they would give nothing in return. So my concern with the president's recent overture is that we didn't really get anything in return, as opposed to, for instance, in Burma, where the administration set some very strict guidelines, and the Burmese junta met them, including releasing political prisoners, moving towards free and fair elections, all of these things. And yet in Cuba, none of that was requested, and none of it was gotten. They're certainly not going to give it for free. So I'm not opposed to making a deal, and the embargo is a chip. It's a bargaining chip. It has value, but you don't give it away. If you make a deal, it's both of us have to get something out of it, and I don't see that happening.
I know this is a bone of contention for anybody who looks at Cuba. You're either absolutely for the embargo or absolutely against it.
Yeah.
But so, and I know you're still for it. So explain why it's important now. It's been going on for, gosh, well over 50 years, and so... What is the United States getting out of it?
I'm going to make two statements.
Okay.
You will probably agree with one, but not the other. And it could go either way. The first one is that economic embargoes do not undermine totalitarian regimes. The second one is trade and tourism do not undermine totalitarian regimes. So let me talk about the first one. The purpose of an economic embargo, as opposed to other forms of blockades and what have you, is to apply economic pressure onto a country. And if you have a democracy, then you have a middle class or a business community who feels the pain from the embargo, and they have a way to express their pain upwards to their elected or appointed or whatever they are, officials who have to be responsive to them. So think South Africa. In South Africa, economic sanctions worked well because there was a community there that felt the pain and reacted on it. Totalitarian regimes, not so much. You know, they basically, you know, Fidel and Raul have never missed a meal in the past 50 years, but a lot of their citizens have. And the citizenry has no way to effectively put this up the level. So what does an embargo do? What an embargo does is it reduces the resources that the regime has to carry out its will. In the case of Cuba, when they had a lot of money from the Russians and others, you know, we had troops in Angola and the Horn of Africa. We had agents running all through Latin America. We had a much larger military. We had all of these things. As they have gotten into economic difficulty, they have cut back on all of these, including the internal repressive mechanisms that are there. So again, I mean, it's not a cure-all and it's not a be-all, certainly. And if I could trade the embargo for getting political prisoners released, not released on Monday and then put back in jail on Tuesday, which is what usually happens, simple things, freedom of association, freedom of speech, being able to read books, I mean, all of these things, to me, that would be a good trade. But simply saying we're going to give it up because we don't think it worked on something it was never designed to do in the first place, not a good deal.
It almost sounds from those two statements you made that perhaps the best thing would be to lift the embargo, and then if you don't get any improvement, slap sanctions on them.
Well, you know, because
sanctions,
we discovered,
although sanctions don't work either, usually.
It's hard to put things back after they've gone. And a concern, and probably this will take a much longer conversation, but you know, even in repressive societies, the governing force requires credibility. They need to have a story, a reason for existence. And whether you're Mao Zedong or Hitler or whatever, you have to have that story that goes with it. And they want legitimacy. And so when we give them legitimacy and get nothing in return, what we're doing is we're solidifying their position, and that the population says, well, I have no hope. There's nothing I can do. And sadly, in Cuba, as I mentioned earlier, they make it very difficult to stay if you're a dissident and easy to leave. So unlike these Germans, you know, who would shoot people on the wall, for the most part, the Cubans are prepared to let people go. In fact, if the United States was not 90 miles away, Key West, not from Miami, no. If that were not the case, if Cuba had not been able to export the counter-revolution, I don't think the Castros would have survived the 60s because people wouldn't put up with it. But they had an option, which was, and at this time, remember, it was firing squads and long-term imprisonment or horrible conditions, and people left. And the people who were most unhappy were the first ones to leave, and the ones who stayed behind dealt with what they had.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the embargo, I mean,
sure.
It seems like Cuba is a special case. I mean, we deal with repressive regimes around the world. We trade with them. Sometimes we consider them have to have special relationships, and yet they have a very repressive government, and sometimes a communist government that we consider politically a no-go situation. Yep. Why is Cuba different?
Well, I'm a human rights guy across the board, and so I'm not particularly supportive of or happy of some of our policies. I think let's take China, for instance.
Well, you mentioned release the political prisoners on Monday and arrest them on Wednesday. That's China in a nutshell.
I agree. and what happens, and one of my second point about trade and tourism not undermining either. Businessmen and women like stability. And what happens, of course, is they become partners with whoever it is on the other side that they're dealing with. So you look at Google or Apple or whoever, and what do they do in China? Well, they end up being partners with
the
regime. Now, you know, we get very inexpensive toys in Target and Walmart and places like that. But we also get billions or trillions of dollars of debt, and we have nations that are acting in ways that are probably not in our long-term interest. And so I understand your point, but what I'm telling you is I would rather see a Cuban standard applied elsewhere rather than the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the pre-Castro Cuba. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, you're describing some of the same things.
Oh, yeah. Look,
I mean, we had all sorts of businesses with very close ties to the Batista regime. Yep. How does that color how Cubans view this sort of, I think I've heard it referred to as a new detente?
Yeah. Well, again, you remember that almost all Cubans were very happy and supportive of getting rid of Batista. And curiously, if you know Batista, you know he was actually considered a Democrat in the 30s and 40s. And then when he came back, he turned into the dictator. But I know personally many people who were anti-Batista. They weren't necessarily pro-Castro, but they were willing to give him the chance, an option.
And some of those exiles you're talking about were anti-Batista people.
Of course.
To begin
and they
with.
Were shot, some of them, and then others fled the country and others adapted to what was there. The Cuban people like people everywhere, I think. I've served in the Foreign Service and I've been all over the place. And my experience is most people, like I said, want the same sorts of things we do. And even if it's just to be left alone, you know, that's what the basically human needs and wants. But whenever you have a situation where people are forced into certain areas in ways that are against their natural interests, then I got a problem with that. And I don't think we should be rewarding it. And look, you have a Pinochet, somebody, and Lord knows, you know, he did enough things down in Chile. He ended up getting arrested in London. But what he did is not 1/100th of the human rights violations that the Castro regime has caused. And yet he's hailed by some, even in America, as a hero, or at least he's given a pass, you know, because, again, you know, good health care and education are important things. But, you know, human rights are also an important thing. And I think there are enough examples in the world, even in Latin America, this hemisphere or worldwide, where you can have both. You know, it's not a choice of one or the other. Let's work to get both. We're not going to get there overnight. It's not going to be, you know, a light switch, but there's things that we can certainly do. And we should be insisting that the Cubans begin to respect their own people.
Now, you've been involved with the Cuban American National Foundation over the years. As you look at, you know, South Florida and the anti-Castro thought that surrounds Cubans in South Florida that have a significant political lobby, which really helps inform that embargo, at least on the congressional side. Mm-hmm. How much is that tied to the Castros themselves, not only Fidel but Raul as well? When Raul goes, does it change the movement at all in your mind?
Yes. In some ways, obviously, when it's a first generation, when it's you or me that lived it, when it was, you know, our father who was killed, when it was our property that was confiscated, if it was our mother who was dragged through the streets and humiliated, you know, that's one level. If it was your grandmother or your grandfather, that's also can be important, but it's not the same visceral feeling. You know, I've been hearing for 30 years, well, the new generation of Cuban Americans don't really care about that much. The reality is that there's always has been and always will be a certain percentage of people who care deeply about these issues, and there are others who don't. But I don't see that percentage changing. And what I have found, again, in the people I deal with, it's not that somebody wants to go back and get the plantation back. Most of these people were middle class at best in Cuba. And so there's no finca, there's no plantation that's out there with their
now,
name on
are
it.
Are there some that sort of have that feeling?
I'm sure there's some, but they're probably, but that's probably in their 80s and 90s.
Absolutely remote. That there's virtually no chance that would happen.
That's
ever.
Correct. Yeah, they, you know, and there's, of course, the whole issue of American property that was seized, which is there's 5,911 certified claims. And interestingly, you might have sort of a 1,000-acre sugar plantation, but what the claimants now are interested in is it happens that 1,000 acres goes up to the edge of the sea, and it's got a nice beach there. And
so they're thinking resort,
not
sugar.
They're thinking beach, yeah, not sugar. You know, look, not even communism can screw up sunshine. You know? So that's still there. And I personally, once Cuba gets out of this nightmare, I'm fairly optimistic, as I say. If you look at what the Cuban Americans have done, it's their cousins that are still in Cuba proper. And given the right environment, I think they will be a powerhouse in the region. And I think that the entire nation will do well. But they've got this force just holding them down. And it's tragic, as I said, that people spend their whole lives not being able to get out from under that and accomplish what they could.
You're very pessimistic about the regime voluntarily liberalizing some of their policies.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But even if they took a couple of steps, mm-hmm. do you think the United States would be prepared to meet them with a couple of steps forward?
Well, we already have. I mean, in many ways. Look, every president from Dwight Eisenhower forward, every single president, Ronald Reagan, the Bushes, not just the Clintons and the Carters and the Johnsons, have reached out to Fidel in those days. And every one of them has been rebuffed because each of them said, we want to have a better relationship, but you have to give us something so politically we can justify what we're doing. And they couldn't get it. The difference is this time we gave it without asking anything in return. And since the agreement of almost 2 years now, December of 2014, arrests are up, migration is up, And trade with the United States is down. I mean, there's significantly less agricultural products being bought by Cuba now than there were 7 or 8 years ago.
Why would that be?
Well, I have a theory, of course.
Okay.
My theory is that trade is a tool for them also, like it is for us in many ways. And so when they were trying to influence the United States for a while there, they would go around. They would come to Oklahoma, and they would go to Kansas, and they would go to Missouri. And basically
we want to buy
say,
wheat.
Hey, we want to buy wheat, you know, and look, people like wheat. I mean, Oklahoma wheat's great wheat, but they're saying they're going to buy your wheat, and they're going to buy Kansas wheat, and they're going to buy Nebraska wheat, and they're going to buy North Dakota wheat, and they don't have that much money. I mean, basically, as you know, the average salary in Cuba is like $24, $25 a month, and that's it. So, again, you don't have that middle class consumer group that would be a good customer. It'll be there. I think it's coming. You know, Cuba and the United States had a great trade relationship for 100 years, and I think it will come back, but you have to have an environment. And let me mention that. See, the Cubans have a consistent philosophy, and if what we don't understand is that they believe in this stuff. And for instance, they see an employer-employee relationship as oppressive. By definition, it's abusive. If I have control over you, that's an abusive relationship. So as a result, everybody has to work for the state because everybody is equal. But what that means, of course, is you don't have any entrepreneurship. You don't have any small businesses. You know, they have the quintuple pistas now, the self-employment. But repairing umbrellas,
repairing cars,
fruit. Not anything, and again, not where you would effectively have a small business.
And you see no sign that that's liberalizing.
Love to see that happening. I mean, to me, that would be a very positive sign if they were able to relax that and say, okay, we're going to allow small businesses. And now it's unfortunate. You have American companies that want to go down there. The system, as you may be aware, is the foreign company hires through the Cuban government. The foreign company pays in dollars for my services, let's say. But I get paid in pesos.
Right.
So effectively 94%.
It's basically a hard currency transfer.
Yeah. So yeah. 94% of the value goes to the state, not to the worker, which the ILO, National Labor Organization, or the UN, defines as slavery, wage slavery. Yeah. So if you want to engage in that, you can, but do you really want to?
Right. Mm-hmm. One last question. Sure. That has to do, I know you're not a specialist on the incoming Trump administration, mm-hmm. but from what you're hearing, mm-hmm. how do you think, I mean, the Trump rhetoric during the campaign was pretty harsh, but now that he's been elected, some of that rhetoric is changing, at least so far. What do you expect the relationship to be?
Well, remember, this is a guy, I think he wrote The Art of the Deal. I mean, that was his thing. And what I would see, and I base this on nothing other than I read the paper and listen to the news, is that an incoming Trump administration will look for a deal where both sides gain something and not give it away for free.
All right. Mm-hmm. Ambassador Hayes, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ambassador Dennis Hayes is the former coordinator of Cuban affairs at the U.S. State Department during the mid-1990s, during the Cuban rafter crisis. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on the future of the Castro-Cuban regime. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.